Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, we, like many people in the Western world, are living in an aging society. This naturally presents challenges to us as individuals and as a country. But thankfully, we happen to have one of the leading studies on aging taking place right here in Ireland. It's called the Irish Longitudinal Study on Aging, or TILDA, and it is 20 years old this year. I'm joined by Regius Professor of Medicine at Trinity College Dublin and founding principal investigator of the programme, Roseanne Kenny. Roseanne, it's always a pleasure to have you on the programme. I think we spoke about it 20 years ago on Futureproof, which is really, really exciting, right? We've been going nearly that long. And we spoke to you at the very early stages of this study. It is so amazing to have such a rich data set that looks at people aging in Ireland very quickly. Tell me a little bit about what's in the data set and how it's set up and how long it's been going.
So as you say, it's been going for 20 years. Four of those were piloting, trying to get the study exact for Ireland. That's the first thing. So we've been following people for 16 years. Basically, it's a longitudinal study, which means we go back to the same people every 2 years. So a big shout out to the participants who are taking part for that long period of time. Mm. We've very low dropout rates, very low dropout rates. Secondly, it's about the experience of aging in Ireland. So what it's like to be getting older in Ireland. And we started with 50 people aged 50 and above. And we currently have 10,500 people taking part because we had to refresh the sample after a period of time with the younger people again. And we actually started with an even younger cohort of 45 plus. So it is aging, but most people, when they think of 45, 50, 55, 60, don't think of aging. And that is true. However, the biology of the process starts early. So it's about capturing as much as possible. And it isn't just about health, but it's predominantly health focused because we collect social information and economic information because health doesn't occur in isolation.
Yeah. So talk us through the sort of information you're gathering from these people every 2 years. It's quite comprehensive. What do you ask them and what do you measure?
So it's a huge amount of data. The whole thing, including the health assessment, because we do an objective assessment as well of health, takes about 5.5 hours. So it's very, very comprehensive. And it's everything that you could possibly imagine, which constitutes the tapestry of your life. You know, where are you living? Who are you living with? How many children do you have? You know, what was your childhood like? We do a lot of childhood questions. What education did you have? How much money have you in the bank? Do you suffer from incontinence? Are you taking tablets? What tablets are you taking? And then what are your social networks like? Do you experience loneliness? What's your mood like? Do you suffer from any anxiety or depression, etc.? And we use specific scales to measure things like loneliness, depression, anxiety. We also measure brain function, cognitive function, lots of memory tests, lots of functioning like planning tests, concentration tests, that sort of thing. So it's everything, almost everything you can possibly think of.
And 10,000 for an island as small of Ireland, as Ireland, that is, we're talking a really representative amount of data. Like, we can really learn valuable stuff from this.
So that's a really important point because it's of virtually no value if the data isn't representative. So the way we started the study out and the first sample, which is the important sample, was complex in Ireland. In other countries, you've got a database with addresses and ages. So you know, okay, I'm going to randomly select these number of people over the age of 50. In Ireland, we just were able to randomly select addresses. We didn't know what age people were. So we randomly selected almost 30,000 addresses and cold called face-to-face at the door on 30,000 houses. Anybody aged 50 or more here, and would you like to take part in a study being led by Trinity College? And remarkably got a 67% response rate.
Incredible, isn't it?
Incredible.
So let's talk a little bit about that then. You have this really representative data set and you have lots of questions that you ask people. What stuff falls out of something like that? Because we often talk on this program about correlation and causation, that you might see something that looks like it might cause a particular symptom or an outcome, but you don't really know how they're related. Maybe the other thing is causing it and the relationship is the other way around, or maybe it's a fluke. But with this sort of level of data, we can actually see things and have a good idea of how something might affect someone's health outcomes. So talk to me about some of the more surprising findings that weren't found elsewhere that are specific to Tildestudy.
You've made a really good point there. First of all, the fact that it's representative means we can generalise from whatever our findings are. So if I found that 40% of people of a certain age have high blood pressure in the Tilda study, I know that that's the case for 40% of people in Ireland that age. That's the first thing. Secondly, the fact that it's longitudinal means that we can actually tease out this conundrum of causality and consequence. And so that's the beauty about longitudinal study design. So that's the value. So if we take in health, for example, one of the major findings we're consistently finding at each wave in health is the undiagnosed diagnosed. How many, the high volume of people who are out there, who are walking around with conditions that can be easily treated and they don't know they have them. That's the first thing. Common things like high blood pressure. 40% of men aged 50 to 65 who are hypertensive don't know they're hypertensive. And those that do, half of them aren't on adequate treatment for the recommended target blood pressure. That's a big negative. Does it matter? Yes, it does. Commonest cause of stroke, of Alzheimer's disease, of heart failure, of kidney failure, high blood pressure.
Wow.
And so easily treated. So I say everybody over 45, know your blood pressure at least every year, if not twice a year. Know your diabetes status. Have blood tests done for that. Have blood tests done for your lipids, fats, that's cholesterol and triglycerides, other fats, etc., LDL. At least know those biomarkers because they're the main ones. They're so easy to treat and they're the biggest causes of the things which cause disability, stroke, heart failure. And, you know, that's what causes not just death, but makes our health span shorter.
Do we see in this data set the differing ways in which people age, like because it's a biological age, right? And then there's the actual age you are in terms of how many years you spent on the planet. Those two things aren't always the same, right? What does the science looking at Irish people have to say about how we age and the things that affect the speed of our aging?
So more and more we're recognising the big difference between what's called chronological age, the number of candles on your birthday cake, and biological age. Really, you're ageing? I can tell you're biologically very young, Jonathan.
Yes,
because
Roseanne.
You clearly work, you know, you work out, you're physically active. Physical activity is hugely important. So we have ways of measuring that, apart from just looking at somebody and saying they look young. Although, believe it or not, that's a really good metric.
Is it?
There have been studies to show that if you look younger than your years, you actually probably are biologically, most likely, younger than your years, obviously surgery apart. So we can measure biologically from just looking at cells and the pathways within cells, lots of different things. Epigenetics is the one we're particularly vexed on, but metabolomics, proteomics, there's lots of different ways. None of them are entirely accurate just yet, but we're getting there. When we started this research 15 years ago, there were 5 so-called aging clocks, biological clocks, as opposed to our chronological age. Now we have something like 50-something.
So, I mean, what are they?
Well, we can, in Tilda, for example, I can tell you the biological age of your muscle, the biological age of your heart, cardiovascular system, the biological age of your visual system. So we're actually able to measure from looking at cells what the biological age of different systems is now, for example. It's great at a population level. It gives you an overall population level. For the individual, it's out by 2 to 4 years, either end. So it's not that accurate yet.
There are moments when I come across someone on the street and I can tell by the quality of their skin almost what sort of life they've had. I'm sure people know, you know, when you can tell almost certainly this person has had struggles with addiction, this person has been on the street a lot. Is our skin a good metric for anything? Can we tell much from our skin?
It's a fantastic metric. The elastic in skin is hugely important. So if you pull somebody's skin out and it bounces back, that's a very good sign. And anaesthetists used to use that sign to judge whether or not older patients were fit for operation before we had more sophisticated tests.
Wow.
So it's been around an awful long time, that particular sign.
So did Tilda say anything about skin?
We're looking at skin. The problem with skin is you have to biopsy it,
right,
and it's quite invasive. So although we do blood tests, stools, we take feces samples, saliva samples, hair samples, taking a skin biopsy is more invasive again, but we're very keen to do this.
Okay, so let's, what about dental stuff? Do you do any dental
stuff?
Okay,
we do a lot of dental stuff.
And so what do our teeth, what do Irish people's teeth tell us about
aging? I would say to you that the bottom line there is that the mouth is the window to the brain. You can tell an awful lot about cardiovascular, your heart function, and the vasculature in the brain from looking at the mouth. So a healthy mouth makes a big difference. And we now know that that's because of a few different things, actually. Organisms that are healthy and organisms that are toxic, that's the first thing. But secondly, we think it's related to stimulation of eating, etc., a certain number of teeth. The fewer teeth you have, the more likely is cognitive impairment, okay? And what's that link? What's that about? It could be about the dental hygiene, etc., but also it may be about stimulating pathways by chewing, because we've evolved to chew, etc., which stimulate parts of the brain necessary for memory and concentration, etc. So there's a big link between the mouth and the heart and the brain. So we do look at that. The other big area with health that we've looked at is social integration, social networking, friendship. This is hugely important. And more we're seeing it as a problem. And social isolation is very toxic to physical, biological health.
Really?
Because it triggers inflammation. Inflammation's great. Inflammation is the response when we get an infection. We need it. We've evolved to need it. What we don't want is that it's chronically grumbling in the background. That's when it actually kills cells and accelerates the aging process. And unfortunately, social isolation is associated with that. People who are lonely are more likely to suffer from dementia. And we know now the causal pathway, that it's the loneliness that triggers inflammation, that triggers dementia, for example.
Wow. And we can see that in Tilda data.
We absolutely can see that in Tilda data. And the important thing about that, I think, is raising awareness and that people nurture friends and social engagement as much as they nurture physical health and the blood tests that I recommend that everybody has at least annually.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about some of the things that come with aging a little bit.
Yeah.
And the thing that I worry a lot about with some people in my life is falls. People talk about falls. Yeah. And a fall, you know, it's not something you think about in your 50s or 60s, but when you get a little bit older, you know, 80s, 90s, a fall can be, it's for some people, weirdly a death sentence. And this is something that was brand new to me as news only 10 years ago. What does Tilda say about falls? Why are they so dangerous? And what data have we got on that?
So the first thing to say is that they're incredibly common as people get older. So in women post-menopause, you see a huge increase in the number of falls every year.
Wow.
And likewise in men after the age of 50. So, and it's a direct relationship with age. The age gradient is very clearly linear. So that's the first thing to say. To the point where 2 to 3 falls a year after the age of 70 is not unusual. It's not universal, however. So people who continue to be active, not just aerobic exercises, but also muscle strengthening exercise programs, are much less likely to fall, if at all. Okay, so that's one thing. You can prevent them. Secondly, a third of falls are unexplained. I didn't slip. I didn't trip. I just don't know what happened.
Mm.
And actually, just this morning, I've had a paper in the New England Journal on this showing that those falls are actually related to drops in blood pressure or abnormalities in heart rate. And they are treatable, but it needs much more microscopic looking into than just making an assumption it's your muscles. It's in 2/3 of cases, it's not your muscles. It's something to do with your blood pressure and your heart.
Right.
So an unexplained fall is a warning that you need more investigation.
What about the more social stuff? So I thought it was really interesting, you know, you swim in cold water. This is, you know, that my friend Ruth Freeman is on the program all the time, swears by it.
Mm-hmm.
Scientifically, there was questions about whether or not it actually does anything. But in the Tilda data set, it seems to suggest that at least there's a correlation between people who swim or have cold showers, cold water, and what? What is the link?
So the mechanism is probably through the autonomic nervous system. The studies, we haven't done this study, there have been randomized control trials now, which actually show that people who have cold water showers every morning for a period of time, these are Dutch studies, compared to those who don't, actually are much less likely to get winter chest infections, require fewer antibiotics during a winter period, and have better attendance at work, higher employment than those. And these are well-matched matched cohorts. So there are now studies out there with respect to the cold shower.
Right.
It's much more difficult to do randomized controlled trial with respect to cold water swimming. But the likelihood is we know cold water swimming has beneficial effects on the vagus nerve. It enhances vagal activity. And that's a good thing. That's your relax and digest nerve. And of course, you're outdoors and it's generally social. So there are a whole lot of other fringe benefits.
Okay, that's cold water. I'm trying to think of my own life. So pets,
yes.
Did you do any studies on pets?
Ah, we've done lovely work on pets, actually. And I was surprised by this work myself. People who have pets are less likely to be depressed.
Hmm.
And now, it's not a randomized controlled trial. It's observational. But there does appear to be a direct association between having a pet and depression. They also have better social engagement and lower inflammatory markers.
Hmm.
And we think it's because when you have a pet, particularly a dog, you know, it requires walking. And when you're walking a dog, you meet other people who are required to walk their dog. So there's inadvertent social engagement
yeah.
when you have a pet.
And this, by the way, if you're a non-dog owner and never had a dog in your life, the transition from being a non-dog owner to a dog owner is way more significant than I thought it was. Firstly, you do have to get out the door. You have to get the door twice a day. But you stop all the time and meet people. I met
yes.
so many people
right.
just because that's part of being a dog. And if you have someone who's on their own
yes.
and doesn't have a dog,
yes.
if they would in any way tolerate it,
yes.
I would highly suggest you let them borrow your dog even.
100%.
And
yeah.
because the social sort of experience of that is something I totally underestimated.
And, you know, we've started to introduce dogs now into care in acute hospitals, even in Mercer's Institute for Successful Aging, where I work in St. James's Hospital. We've introduced dogs for the last number of years, particularly with stroke patients and that. The difference, you'll see a person completely light up when an animal comes into the room, and then they can touch and hold and hug an animal. Patients who've got severe dementia transform
yeah.
when there's a pet that
you can't do that with a nurse, for example.
so we see it in those scenarios, and it gives you some sense of how we've evolved
yeah.
to need animals
yeah.
and to enjoy
and,
them.
And touch, we know how important touch is.
Touch
and
is
if you're on
important.
Your own and
yes.
all you have is, you know, a carer or you're living completely on your own, you don't have that. It's really important.
And
to
the other
have
thing that
life.
We need as humans is purpose, to have a purpose. And an animal gives you purpose.
Yeah.
Where previously, you, as you just said, it's the big difference it makes into your life. Part of that is having a purpose.
Yeah. And then the other thing, which I thought was really interesting, which is something that I've always, I mean, obviously, there's a cost that's associated with this. And I'm going to put my hand up and say, I'm fully acknowledging that. But living near water seems to have some sort of benefit. Mm. Is that, I mean, could we say, well, obviously you can afford to live near the sea or near a lake, then obviously you have more money and you have better health outcomes? Mm. Or are you able to isolate this from socioeconomic things and say...
So it's a very good point. I mean, insofar as you can adjust, you can never purely adjust in science, no matter what they say.
Yeah.
You can't,
yeah.
you know. That's the reality. But insofar as you can adjust for socioeconomic circumstances... Blue exposure to blue space has an independent beneficial effect. And it's predominantly a calming effect. That's the first thing. Secondly, there's a lot of variety involved, particularly in the ocean. It's never the same.
Mm.
And variety is something that stimulates us and is good for us as humans and or as animals. And then also physical activity. You're more likely to be physically active if you're near blue space
yeah.
than near concrete, for example.
We are so lucky to have Roseanne in this country having spearheaded this study, because it is amazing to have this level of data. Mm. There's so many studies coming out of it. 20 years and going strong. I'll see you in 10 years, Roseanne. And I'm
okay.
sure you'll look exactly the
okay.
same. Thank you so much for joining us,
okay.
Roseanne Kenny there from the Tilda study.
Thank you.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.